morning, fellow perverts. Good morning, middle spoons. How are you doing out there in internet land? It is Monday after daylight savings time, and you've only got your pals at the Soxcast to help get you through that. No coffee. You're cut off. Taking away
being a middle spoon
caffeine
is the best.
Exactly. Exactly. Welcome to Soxcast episode 168. I definitely got that on the first try.
Almost the sex number.
Almost the sex number. When we hit that sex number, we are all seriously going to sit here and have a moment where we just kind of reflect and go, nice. And everybody's going to laugh. Because
yeah,
that's literally the funniest thing you could do. Look, if Elon Musk thinks it's funny, it's got to be
it
the
absolutely must be.
It's got to be the pinnacle of comedy. You know, carry a sink into Twitter headquarters. That's hilarious. So, daylight savings time. We all hate it, but we got to struggle through it together, and we're going to be the ones to pull you right through. I am your host, Polly, and I'm a gigantic asshole, and I am, of course, joined to my immediate right. His palms are sweaty. His knees weak. His arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. It's mom's spaghetti. He's nervous, but on the surface, he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. Is Rhett.
Hello.
But you did not keep on forgetting the words that you wrote down. The crowd goes so loud, you open your mouth, but the words don't come out. Nothing happened like that.
Yeah, that's an Eminem reference, but I don't know the rest of that song besides the mom spaghetti part.
I mean, that's literally, the song is just called Mom Spaghetti, probably. You just look it up.
Probably.
Just call it Mom Spaghetti song. That's probably
Mom
it.
Spaghetti. Mom Spaghetti lyrics popped up immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that is what, that is good. Like, you name your song Lose Yourself, and everybody's just going to remember the Mom Spaghetti part. And you're just mom. You're just the guy that rapped Mom Spaghetti.
Mm-hmm. Coming out of your pockets.
Coming out of your pockets. You could, man.
In a GameStop.
I'm imagining myself now, because I'm kind of wearing a coat, because I'm a little cold, and I'm imagining now if I had just kind of had spaghetti in my pockets, and it's just like, man, just like a nice, slimy, wormy friend. While you
just
walk
fistful of cold, loose spaghetti,
yeah,
on a hot day.
God, it's almost a little gross.
almost.
There's a comfort. So, look, sometimes there's a comfort, man. Like, you know, sometimes the worms are comforting. You ever just have some comfort worms? Just put them in your pocket.
It's a Renner Yuga moment.
Yeah. Comfort worms. They're in your throat. You just got to scratch a little bit to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
You play with
how the Matt Sounds bit play out with our fandom? How do they react on the how do the audience surveys come
all
back
right,
via the
so
Mouth Sounds bit?
The surveys came in, John. Okay. You had this brilliant idea for a Mouth Sounds thing to start
well,
out to
idea,
jump everybody
your idea
back in. We're gonna revolutionize things. We're gonna change the podcast game, John said to me minutes before we go live to record. Mouth Sounds. Well,
let's do something deliberately. Really, let's do something deliberately off-putting specifically to listen to in an audio medium. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got the reports back and just a great big old no on that. Just nope. Don't want none of that. We gave them a form and it had numbers. How much did you like that segment? 1 to 10. They didn't even circle the numbers. They just wrote big red no on the middle of the page. And I don't even know how they did that because I didn't even give them red pens.
It's like a weird CSS trick, I think.
Gotta be. So that went over.
You can do anything with CSS. It's wild.
That went over about as well as like a Spam and Colgate sandwich. So no more Mouth Sounds.
Oh, God. It took me a second to remember what Colgate was, and then I was the visceral image just struck me so hard.
Well, my brain was going either Spam and Colgate or like mayonnaise and toothpaste. Like both of those sound equally lovely, I think.
Spam and Colgate was perfect. Oh,
the listeners are saying this segment also gross.
Yeah, I got a bad feeling about what the numbers are going to come in on this segment too. Like the sandwich bit, nobody's going to like the sandwich bit. We've really got to get our bit game going.
They're making a circle, but it's a zero.
Yeah. Oh my god. So Speaking of the Sox cast, we're back, of course, and a lot of people had a lot of great response to the show coming back. So, of course, I want to thank everybody for taking the time to download and listen to the new episode. I got a lot of people come to me directly. Hey, so glad the show's back. And you know what? We're glad that you're glad, because we basically didn't change anything and people still like us for some reason.
Feels good.
It does. It does. I did want to take a moment to answer a couple of questions that I did receive about the show and how it's going to move going forward. I was asked specifically a number of times if people would be able to be on as guests, and I don't think we're going to be going that route anymore. Unless it's for like special events, you know, like we do have a 200th episode to look forward to very soon, right? Like only 32 episodes from now, but it's something to think about. And we also will not be streaming the show live anymore. Everything's going to be pre-recorded. It's just easier this way. Less performative, less anxiety inducing. Everybody can just kind of chill and we can do our own thing, and we can definitely not record bits when they're not, you know, completely flopping. Or, you know, when you yell at your co-host accidentally. Never had to do that, but in the case that that has ever had to happen, now you never have to know.
This isn't live.
It would be so embarrassing.
It would be really awful if it was live.
Would that not be the most embarrassing? I mean, if that ever happened to us in the first place.
No.
Not a thing that I could think would ever be. We have fun here on the Sox cast, and we want you to as well. And we like that you're engaged with us and you're going to continue to do so. So thanks for making our return as exciting for you as it is for us. That probably needed to go the other way, but you get what I mean. How does podcasting work? John, talk about things, please.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, we got a twofer here, but I feel like we talked about it. I feel like we talked a bunch about Berzeria last time.
But I think there's a coda to that, right?
Exactly. I want to tie this off and tie it together with another RPG. Look, I love weird little freeware games. I love playing shit on itch. I think that talking at length about like RPGs and long form old games is kind of nice, because there's almost like, I had this thought where I was glad that I had been posting like RPG reviews on my blog, and I'd never made a push to become like an indie curator, like an itch curator, even though I play a bajillion itch games. Cause it's like,
even though the cream of the crop developers always come to me and follow me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. even though I'm uniquely disposed to, help curate, to help like show off cool shit.
I'll uniquely dispose you. Sure.
disposed. I say, oh,
I'm being mean, John.
That's okay. But like, I'm glad that I feel like I'm in a very nice block. I'm in a very nice space with the itch games, where that is just like, it's like a kind of very fun zone. So I'll bring stuff up here when I feel like I've got a good segment on it. Mm-hmm. But I can also I just fucking love RPGs, and I can talk about those for ages. So I like the balance I've struck here. But yeah, I finished Berzeria, and then, I was playing them at the same time. I also played the original Megami Tensei, the Super Famicom version.
Okay.
Yeah, so let's not get ridiculous here. My friend Sreika plays the most like dank old school RPGs possible. Mm-hmm. Like, they played all of Final Fantasy II on Famicom.
They
fucking loved it. They had a great time. It was like 40 hours, apparently.
You gotta have a mental fortitude that I just do not have anymore to handle that level of jank.
My friend Wuzzy bought a Final Fantasy II cartridge off of eBay. It was like a repro with the fan translation. Played it for like 10 hours and then realized, this isn't Final Fantasy II. This is an unlabeled ROM hack of Final Fantasy II that makes it harder. And they spent a bunch of time browsing romhacking.net until they finally found the ROM hack, and they identified like what they were playing. And then they played it through to the end had a great time. after already having played Final Fantasy II, both of them saw Megami Tensei 1 on Famicom through to the end, and it destroyed them. They hated it.
And John's like, perfect game for me. Let's go.
No, that's why I'm saying I didn't play the Famicom version, because they played the Famicom version. They said it took like 50 hours, because it's a graph paper maze game.
Oh god!
And the maps are fucking huge.
I've seen those original Megami Tensei maps, and they are not friendly.
They are huge and they're empty. They don't even have that many like cool gimmicks.
Nah,
like
it's just mazes, dog.
It's mazes all the way down. You just get to fucking do them, and you better explore all of them because there's some important thing tucked away. So it just killed both of them. They both hated it. They both like saw it through to the end begrudgingly. And then Strike said it killed their RPG vibe for like six months.
God, load up Maze Craze on Atari 2600, and that's your dungeon.
There are some gimmicks in the back half, and I think that the more gimmicks like spinners and pitfalls and teleporters, the good shit, of course.
Oh, love a teleporter maze.
We love teleporters.
I'm famously known for loving
them. Mm-hmm. I think they toned a lot of that stuff down in the SNES version because I was comparing the maps because the maps are different in both. I couldn't tell you if there's a version where the mazes are really more interesting, because some of the mazes are a little more compact on the SNES version. I don't know. I don't know if there's a better option here, but in any case, the mazes are mostly empty, I'm pretty sure, in both versions. Mm. And you just spend a lot. I spent probably like 20 to 25 hours on the Super Famicom version. That's with the auto map and the much faster combat. So The arc here, the tying it with Berseria here, is I finished Berseria since the last podcast, and the ending made me cry a lot.
Yeah.
So it's game of the year so far.
No, I'm not rad.
No, yeah, that's my thing.
But I still like it when I cry a lot. And so Berseria is a game where, like, the systems are junk.
Oh, God,
the RPG part of that game is kind of rancid. Yes. The best thing it has going for it is that the fights are over pretty quickly, relative to like a slow turn-based game. But the fights, I liked it more than Berseria. I felt like I was still a little more on edge by the end than I was in Vesperia. Mm. And maybe I just liked going ham with the hyper mode.
Yeah, the hyper mode feels good.
It feels good. And Vesperia didn't really have that. Vesperia, it's like, figure out how to do the chaining and then chain like one combo together over and over, which feels a little technical. It's kind of cute. But, you know, do it for 60 hours.
You almost feel like you're playing a competent action game.
Yeah.
You can pretend.
But then everything just, once you're doing the chains, everything, if you can do the chaining, then everything just melts.
Yeah.
And I don't think the game would be better playing without that, because it's not a good action game. It's a Tails game. So the systems are rancid. It's full of clutter. You collect. Here's the indignity of Tales of Berseria. Every single map in the game has these floating orbs shimmer. And they're exactly like Mario coins.
Yeah.
And you collect them. Mm-hmm. And periodically you run into these pink treasure chests and you can open them. And then they says you need to exchange 300 or of these orbs to open the chest. And then you do. And then about half the time a kitty cat pops out, waves at you, and then vanishes.
Yep.
And that's it.
That there's nothing. You got nothing for doing that.
And then the other half of the time, they give you a cosmetic item.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a completely worthless system. And the funny thing is, when you leave an area, those damn things respawn. So they're literally not even unique or interesting. There's no like fun puzzle to getting to one or to getting to a cluster of them that would make exploring the world fun and interesting. It's just now here's some. They're just scattered all around like Mario coins. You leave, you come back in, grab them again.
I have found that like 3D games developers are like, if the player's just holding up for a while, they're gonna get bored. So we're just going to have like a tiny little collectible that you hit like every second to stimulate your brain a tiny bit so that you don't get as bored.
Mm-hmm. You know how they handled that back in the day? They just had small levels.
Yeah.
And it was fine. Yeah.
But small levels look bad in 3D is the thing.
I mean, Ease 8 is made up of small levels. Yeah. It's great. It's cute.
Outcome is on a different level.
But they do a good job. Like, East does, like, East 8 especially does a really good job of having a big world with lots of doodads to run around and find. Even just chests where it's just like, oh, this is a chest and I did put in the work to get it. And it's just a fucking, it's just like, oh, it's just another potion or something. But at least there was like a challenge to getting it. Like, they usually kind of lock these things either behind some kind of progress gate or, that you have to remember or like, hey, you had to do some tricky platforming to get over here and get this like revival thing, and it's like that's fun, but like with these little purple pieces of popcorn, it's literally just stimulate my brain every 20 seconds because I was literally born in the year 2003.
My memory of Ease 10 is that they let you dash like crazy everywhere, but then there are also like little blue gems fucking everywhere, just like ching 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 ching, and then you spend something and it's like this requires 1200.
So it's just one of those modern RPG things that's just detestable to me. I'm just let me play the game. I want to like take a machete to Tales of Berseria. When I play a modern RPG like Berseria, I want to take a machete to it and just chop out systems, chop out areas, chop out side quests, just make it smaller, make the cut down to the thing about this that I like. Because there is a thing about this that I like. I like the story. I like the characters.
It's so good.
We had like a good 20 minute chat about the theming in Berseria. It was nice. There's heft to it.
It's a story where the writers had balls, they had conviction, and they stuck to it and landed it.
Yeah. They fulfilled the promises laid out in the meaty intro, which is the same thing Vesperia did. No, not Vesperia. Fantasia did, that I really liked.
Vesperia did not.
Vesperia doesn't have a meaty intro. And then once you get past the first chunk, the first like 10-hour arc, I couldn't tell you a thing that happens in that game. And I played it like 4 years ago. I don't remember what the villain wanted in Vesperia.
So nothing burger, dude.
Oh my God. It's just a big fat nothing burger of a game. It had like one big idea of like making it with like Yuri and how he treats some, handles some of the villains early on and they don't follow up on it. They just
gutless.
Gone. Yeah. Berseria is not gutless. Berseria. Berseria hit the notes that it wanted to. It had the kind of teeth I want from a anime RPG. I think it stands toe to toe in a lot of respects with like the ones that I like the from this era, like the early, like a lot of the first five Trails games that I played and Xenoblade. And I think in a lot of respects, Berseria brings stuff to the table that those games don't do as well. I think that rules.
See, I think it has more conviction than a lot of Trails games, especially modern Trails games. I think that Berseria is admirable for pulling the trigger on the things that it pulls the trigger on.
Because it sure does. Oh, it sure does. It's a PG-13 game, but like,
I wish that game had been rated M. Like, I wish they could have had so much more fun with what they were going for, because it is a Tales game that has teeth. But it is a Tales game that has teeth.
It's a Tales game still. It's still a Tales game. Let's not oversell it.
Yeah. It's still that.
But that's what I went in expecting. And like, it delivered more, well over what I expected, even having kind of sung up a little bit by you and friends. So I was really pleased when I wrapped it up. But it was pleased purely on like, I saw these character journeys through to the end. This was a cool anime shaped like an RPG and I like that when it lands.
Like if this was like a really well produced visual novel, it would have probably like maybe have been better. Honestly,
I think stuff like Berseria and Trails like benefit. It's delivering an RPG shaped journey where like you have a big scary dungeon and you fight these two epic boss fights cause you climb up the tower, things that would feel a little bit thin in the context of like a pure prose work, but work in an RPG. So it's not like, it's a one-to-one, this should just be a VN, but it's like that, where like I'm playing this for the story and for the shape of an RPG journey and not the actual specifics of playing the RPG. So what is as much the opposite of that as you can get? Because I think you make a case.
I know where we're going. I see the case presented.
Because like, you don't take a machete to Megami Tensei. The problem is that there's not enough there. I'm a minimalist. I think that comes through in the games I like, the games that I talk about.
That you make.
That I make, yeah. I like getting the point across with as few moving parts as possible. And Megami Tensei is a game where the actual problem is that there are too few moving parts. Mm-hmm. The systems are simple. Fusion is simple. Character progression is simple. And it carries that length for 25 hours of exploring. Like, yeah, you could chop out, make the mazes smaller, and that would also work. Mm-hmm. But that's not the route that they go. Because I've played other Megami Tensei games. I know they fix this. They fix it by adding stuff.
They
make the demon fusion more complicated. They make negotiation more cool, interesting, and fun. They add more to the story.
This motherfucker just called negotiation fun.
That shit ain't fun. Like, literally, it's just a coin flip. I'm sorry the illusion away from you, John, but demon negotiation in SMT is literally just a coin flip.
Well, that's not how it worked in Last Bible. It turns out there's four different trees and in Last Bible, and they all have different, they have like a set root of like things that of the correct answers. So if you just mash X on Last Bible, like I did for most of the game, you don't get any demons.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cause I know that when I played Nocturne a few years ago, I was literally just I know that game, like whether you're getting a demon or not, is literally decided when the fight starts. So the answers mean nothing. So I just jammed the confirm button anytime negotiation came up.
So fucking funny. Yeah. I thought about jumping straight to Nocturne because, like, I feel like I'm entering my Mega 10 era. I touched Persona. I played Persona 4 in high school. Mm-hmm. I played the baby easy iPhone version of SMT 1, mm-hmm. not knowing it was the baby easy version, and being kind of bored the whole time. Mm-hmm. It was literally like, I wish that any of these bosses were scary. And that's because I played the easy mode version.
It's a mobile game. It's gonna be a baby game.
It's based on the GBA version, which the PS1 version added an easy mode and then it had the original difficulty. The GBA version takes all the stuff from the PS1 version, like the new backgrounds and whatnot, takes the easy mode, makes it the normal mode, and you can't play it in the original difficulty anymore.
That's bad.
Yeah, it sucks. And I didn't know this. So playing Megami Tensei 1, the thing that did thrill me the whole time was that the bosses are always scary as hell. I played SMT4 when it came out. I played like the first 10 hours up to the Minotaur. And then I got scared because anytime an RPG opened up back then, I was like, what do I do?
What do I do? It's so confusing.
I can just go anywhere.
A scary thing about a Megami Tensei game is when it opens up, when fusion becomes a thing, and you realize that your special little Pokemon friends, you have to throw them away because they're all expendable, because they're the only way you're going to get anywhere. But it's like, what if I do it wrong? What if I'm never able to get this one guy that I had again? And a little bit of a fear sets in playing an SMT game. I get that. I absolutely do.
But that part rules. I love how much you have to just chew through your Pokemon. Like they're
not your special little pals. They're just like, they're just tools to be used.
I mean, that's how Wizardry encourages you to treat your party in the original game, because they will die. They get destroyed and you just have to feed a new party into the meat grinder. You're not playing as your characters in Wizardry. You're playing as the guild master hiring these people to funnel them in. It's great. So playing Megami Tensei 1, exploring all of Daedalus Tower, and then fighting the Minotaur, getting my ass kicked, and then like exploring past that, doing some other stuff, coming back, barely beating the Minotaur after doing a bunch of prep. That's as good here in the first game as it was in SMT4 30 years later. They got the bones down day one. Yeah. And that fucking rules.
Yeah, like the fact that that is still such a strong thing right out the gate, and that like, and that formula really hasn't changed a lot. Like, that is just kind of how the texture of those games always feel out the gate. They nail that, like, that's such a strong thing to have stuck around for as long as it has. It's very Dragon Quest-y in a way.
Yeah, it's a great, there's just a great Dragon Quest arc to playing these games, and they got that part down immediately, and it was fun the whole time. I didn't start frame skipping at all like I thought I might.
That's cool, actually.
I did listen to a few podcasts.
For the last dungeon, I did put on a couple Behind the Bastards, yeah.
Perfect. That's like the perfect vibe for Shin Megami Tensei's themes a lot of the time.
I will say, the last dungeon itself, they got an 8-floor tower that is small and full and interesting obstacles and shapes going up the whole tower. Mm-hmm. So they ended on like the highest note they could.
That's good.
And I found all of the optional things that make the bosses easier, because that's another thing I liked. Like, there's a statue you can find in Medusa's dungeon that will lock away her ability to instantly petrify a character. And all the bosses have these things where it's like you are gathering info about the boss from NPCs and then finding things and then using all that info to beat them. And that's true for every boss.
That's very cool. Yeah, like, that is such a cool thing that I wish it were ever really revisited substantially.
Yeah, it felt like a 3 to 4 hour... every boss was like the 3 to 4 hour, like, okay, I'm hearing about the boss for the first time, I'm gathering intel,
it's
I'm prepping to fight them. And then you beat him and it feels amazing on your fourth try.
Like, there's it's sort of comparable, but not directly, but it's the way that you have to find the dungeons in Persona 4, where you've got to spend like 3 or 4 days doing investigation around town and talking to people.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like that in a way. And I wish that like more modern SMT or even Persona games would do more stuff like that.
I like that, and
I like the fact that it can be used in the means that it is in this game, where it's like, oh, you're actually like, you're doing things and you're putting in time to like make your time against the boss easier. It's sort of in the same way that like when you fight the final boss of Xenogears, if you go and knock out the orbs around the boss, you take away a lot of its worst attacks. So it's a similar thing. I like it when games do that.
And a couple of bosses, I beat them before I found the thing that makes them easier, and that felt really good.
And it's
too
really cool that is an option. I like that. That's a thing that can be done, because a lot of the time that would just be like, oh, you just can't do it because it's scripted. Mm-hmm. I can see a lot of lesser RPGs making that a shitty process that you have to do. But the fact that you can be good enough and yet your team composition can be smart enough to work past that gate, and while the enemy is still at like a higher level or a bigger threat, I think is a very cool thing.
Absolutely. And one more thing I love is that the boss gates are not marked. The first four bosses, I think it was either 3 or 4, I just walked into, no, it was the first four. I walked into the boss room not knowing if it would be the boss room or not. There's three. I didn't expect it to be the boss room. Mm-hmm. And I was like, dum, ba, dum, ba, dum. And every time there was like a hint, there's something that I could have known to deduce that was the boss room. And I walk in probably on a full moon and then get my ass kicked.
That's good.
25 minutes into the crawl. And I'm just like,
you got Shin Megami Tensei'd.
There's level draining enemies in the back half. It's the worst.
That is the absolute much. I couldn't do that these days. If I fought an enemy that took my levels away, it's like, nope, we are resetting right the fuck now.
Yeah, so I ate it once when I was like 40 minutes in, and then the characters were out of sync the rest of the game, and it irked me the whole time. One more thing I loved. I think the only hard gate for beating all of the tyrants, all the bosses, is that you need to beat at least several of them to get the thing that locks away Lucifer's full heel.
Oh, jeez.
So you go in to fight Lucifer at the end of this really cool dungeon, hold up the orb, and it seals away his full heel. And I'm realizing this was 1987. This was before Dragon Quest III did exactly that.
Exactly that.
And then Final Fantasy IV ripped it off there.
Yep.
Megami Tensei 1 did one of my favorite RPG boss tropes. First, before Dragon Quest 3. Fuck yeah, man. God, yes. You also can get a legendary sword before the fight with Lucifer. And that was one of the things I just didn't find, because I actually had to like use critical thought and not just fill in all the cells. So I beat Lucifer just barely without the legendary sword. It took like 12 minutes. Nice. And the rounds go by really fast. So that's an eternity for this game. Yeah. And right before the end, he used his curse ability and insta-killed my healer. And I was just like, please God, please God, please God. Just I already resigned to the game over having to do that crawl again. Mm. And then we scraped by and I yelled, fuck, into the apartment. Felt amazing. So, two games, two RPGs, enthralled me and prompted a really strong emotional response out of me in completely opposite ways, and then were alternately very frustrating and annoying to play in completely different ways.
They're literally polar opposites with how these things line up. It's very funny.
To be clear, I love both games.
Sure. Yeah. I wasn't sure for a while because like I couldn't tell when you were talking about
it. I wasn't sure either until I saw the end of Berseria and realized they actually were going to keep all their promises.
Yeah.
Made me really happy.
I wasn't sure how you were going to feel about either of them, though, because like throughout your journey through both of them, like just hearing you talk about them sounded like you were having such a bad time.
And you just never know. Sometimes you're going to get to the end of Star Ocean and realize, oh, that was just stupid bullshit.
Cool. It was just nothing.
It was just nothing. And then other times you get to the end, and it's like, fuck yeah, man. I love these games. I love RPGs. It's a junk food genre in the sense that these are games where you sit down and fight 1,000 random encounters for 30 hours. Mm-hmm. But my brain likes that kind of repetition. I like action games where I fight the same levels over and over. I like RPGs where I fight random encounters over and over.
It's very similar to my love of dungeon crawlers in so much that it's like, you know, like the moving around the dungeons and stuff is fun. Like I like you, it's addictive to just like uncover all the cells in a map and just see that whole thing. And you open the map.
Feels good.
It feels real good. And like those popcorn encounters, it's just like, I'm like mowing down thousands of enemies. There's just a comfort to it that your brain latches onto that feels good. Even when the game maybe isn't living up to the greatest parts of like what the best examples of this genre can be.
That's like there's a core RPG journey where even if I'm playing something like Star Ocean or Final Fantasy Legend 3 or whatever, I'm generally having at least a little bit of fun just from that basic RPG foundation. Mm-hmm. I feel a little intimidated by a lot of friends because I feel like they can approach these games in a more intellectual way. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of accepting the lizard brainness
brain
of how
empty.
I play them.
No thoughts, brain empty, press button, number get bigger. Feel
number
good.
Get bigger.
Anyway, I started Megami Tensei 2 and it fucking rolls. So.
Said you weren't gonna.
All right, I was wondering. I wasn't sure. Like, I thought, I was like, is there going to be like, I started Nocturne Reveal or Megami Tensei 2? I wasn't sure.
That was it.
No more RPGs for a month.
Nope. Rhett, it's bad out there. RPGs are nice. So the thing is, it's not just committing to Megami Tensei 2. It's like, do I want to play these games in order? Get to Nocturne in like 4 years. Because I know Nocturne and probably Strange Journey, I think, are going to be my faves. Because I did play a big chunk of Strange Journey back in the day.
Yeah, those games, like the atmosphere of those games is really what makes me love Nocturne and Strange Journey.
Mm-hmm. So I'm excited, but I love these retro ones too. I'm really loving the ways that Megami Tensei 2 evolves the formula. I think it's adding a lot of what I was missing from the first game. Also, this is really what did the trick. When you beat Megami Tensei 1 and it just goes straight from the ending into a new file of Megami Tensei 2. It doesn't pause to let you save. It doesn't do, it just immediately goes into it. And I'm like, well,
I wish
you fucking got me.
It's the thing that I wish East 1 and 2 Chronicles would have done.
Yeah.
This also makes me want to actually get back to actually playing Toho Artificial Dream in Arcadia, which is the SMT like that's very much based on that SNES game. And I played a good 7 or 8 hours of it back in the day, but you just got like, you know, again, dungeon crawlers and me. I love them, but I got to be in the mood. But yeah, it was already really good. And I think it captured a lot of that same kind of feeling that you're getting from Megami Tensei.
fucking I'm all on board. And SMT1, like a version of that game that has chunky bosses is going to be a joy to me.
Yeah. So yeah, for sure.
Love RPGs. Good segment.
They're good.
Rhett.
Okay. What have you been up to? Are you guys okay with me talking spoilers about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth?
I am more okay with that than anything on earth.
Yeah. Like, I don't think, okay, like, as much as, like, I loved Final Fantasy VII Remake.
I'm more talking to the audience, I think.
Yeah, I get that. Like, look, man, Rhett's probably going to talk big game about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And I don't know, like, it sounds like one of those things where you can't talk about it.
It's going to be hard.
Unless you try and like do the biggest Michael Jackson around some of the shit that
do we want to do Polly's segment and then circle around to Final Fantasy VII so that we can just kind of have that hard line? I'm okay with that.
Yeah, we could do an audible if you would like to get audible. Like, get me out of the way that way if like people want to skip that last segment I have to imagine that's going to be a huge part of the Rhett segment.
Yes, I think that's complete.
Yeah.
Either that or we can put in a timestamp here.
Sure.
Bye. All right. What do you have to?
We'll audible and we'll go to me. Hi, how's everybody doing? Y'all like anime girls?
Yes.
What's the general consensus? The general SoxCast consensus on anime girls is I kind of feel like them a lot.
Polly, my love of anime girls has started when I was young and it has gone through endless iterations and evolutions over the years, and I feel it as strongly as ever.
It's strong in our hearts, and I have to feel that's a sentiment that runs pretty deep with our entire community, probably. Just big on anime girls, we love them.
John's love of anime girls is but a single drop of water in my infinite ocean.
Nobody can possibly love anime girls as much as Rhett.
Really not.
Rhett, you are an infinite, you are a sprawling ocean. I am a glass of the finest wine. Both have their place, but I will not have my love of anime girls besmirched.
Wow.
I like this. He's really standing up for himself. It's like, no, you will not take this from me.
I love anime girls, Rhett.
All right.
Me too.
Okay. All right. I know.
So I played a very cute game about a cute anime girl.
Ooh.
I played Me Side.
Oh, geez.
I don't have to dance around this one or be cute about it. So it's all on the Steam page. But this is a game that actually kind of, this was on somebody's end of the year list, I remember. Because I remember looking at it like a day or two before we did Game of the Year, and then I like, wait, that game's like still in early access, so I didn't really pick it up because I didn't, you know, I don't buy early access games. I'm a bad person, I know.
There's nothing morally wrong with saying no to games that aren't finished.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah. It's when they release and then, you know, they say, here's their soft launch, you know, couple.
That's what I want is a nice flaccid launch.
Miiside came out December 10th, so I think it was just in before we did Game of the Year.
Yeah, I knew that it came out somewhere around the holidays because I know that like I had seen some people stream it and the game like locks you into like holiday mode when you play it on the holidays. So it's snowing in the
like
house
a week after release.
It's very silly. And I think like Rhett, I think you got this for me for Christmas, I think, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
But so again, I'm not going to sit here and try to be cute and dance around it and be cheeky and try to, oh, it's a cute little anime game. This is a first. Go ahead.
It plays its hand like 30 minutes in, maybe
not even
shorter.
That, dude, it's so obvious. Like even from the jump, you know something's going on. It's a first person psychological horror game, and these have kind of like been popular for a long time. I think. Streaming has kind of made this genre more prevalent in recent years. And for me, like, it goes all the way back. Like, I played the original Slender Man game. That's kind of like my touchstone for this kind of horror game. But I think, like, the trend recently now is like, there's a, like, the recent trend is like doing these with cute anime girls, basically. You know, like, the other one that I heard of is a Psycho no Satoka, I think it's called. I'd seen somebody stream that one. And so I guess Miiside could kind of be considered a bit of a Me Too. Mm-hmm. Me too.
The vibe.
It could be considered a bit of a me too. I'll let you laugh here. Go ahead.
I'm laughing. Okay, we're waiting for John to laugh.
I was actually kind of struggling to understand the context.
Oh.
Okay. Okay. I continue.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. They're probably going to go.
That's the sequel.
Zero too. On that bit too. Okay. So the conceit for this game is that someone sends you this updated version of this little life Tamagotchi style mobile game where you take care of this cute little anime girl named Mita. You know, like you do the things that you do. You like buy her little presents, like help her clean her apartment. You make food, like all that fun stuff.
You grind coins because it's a mobile game.
Yeah, you actually do. You've got to grind coins to do the things that she wants. And she starts asking for a lot of very specific items. And then, like, you end up playing this game for like 40 days or so. And she eventually ends up building this in-game machine that somehow actually pulls you into the game world with her. And it's very seamless too, the way you end up in the world from looking at your cell phone to like looking up and you're like in the room with her. Very cool effect. And you're just like in the apartment, her little four-room apartment, walking around with her. And the thing that, like, this is gonna sound weird because this is the moment that totally pulled me in, and I don't even know why, because it's not even one of like the scary moments or anything that they're going for. They're not even doing anything weird. It's just there's this moment when you get pulled in and you visit the kitchen and she starts cooking up dinner and she wants you to help just like you helped in the mobile game. Well, in the mobile game, like she wants you to like cut up the carrots. So when you do that in the mobile game, you're looking at your phone and you like draw this little line with your mouse across the carrot to cut it into segments, right? Mm-hmm. So like when she pulls you into the world, like you have to like grab the carrot, put it on the cutting board, grab the knife, and instead of doing like the little mobile game motion to cut it, you have to actually do like chopping motions with your mouse. And there's just this weird moment of where, oh, this feels really tangible to me now. And I'm just like, cool. I'm immediately immersed. Like somehow that was like the thing that jumped me into like being fully immersed and like, all right, game, I'm here. I will live in your world for now. You set the rules. I am just a visitor. And for some reason, that moment of just like going from like doing the mobile game motions to just like, oh, like I've got to move my mouse like I'm actually cutting these carrots, like was just the moment that made it stick for some reason. So you can imagine like at some point things kind of go haywire and like the horror game starts. And the conceit is that you will be traveling through like these different older versions of the game. You've got to travel backwards to get out. So you've got to go through the older versions of the game and Mita. So you end up meeting all of these different kind of Mitas from different versions of the game that like are completely different personalities, and they've got their own style. There's just like, yeah, like every sequence is like a new, unique, and like fun little roller coaster ride in like the first person horror train, I guess. Like, and you're meeting all of these fun new takes on this character that's also trying to force you to stay and or maybe kill you. And like, I can't say enough about how much I enjoyed like every segment of the game. Like it's like there's spectacle everywhere. And there's also just so much to enjoy about like every version of Mita you meet. Like there's like they put so much work into their characterization of this character that she has a lot of unique animations, like the way she kind of just like walks around and sidles up to you every now and again, or it's just like little things, like if you stand around for a couple minutes, your character will like pull out a, like a handheld game and start playing it, and she'll just come over and like yoink it out and just be like, what's this, and start playing it herself. Like just little things like this to kind of personalize her in ways that are really, really interesting. And like it feels a cut above what I usually see in these kinds of games. Like maybe it's all boilerplate, I don't know, because I don't play this genre a lot.
Yeah, but I don't think there's anything that's quite like this, because it kind of felt like they took the first-person horror trend and combined it with Doki Doki Literature Club's antagonist.
Yeah, like there's so much characterization going on with the character that like it's just so fun being around her and like just like listening to everything she has to say and like playing around there's a lots of ways that you can actually just like mess with her and play around in the house and like call her attention to different things for every version. So there's like literally like 13 different versions of her or something, and they're all like vastly and unique and interesting and cool and different.
Who's your favorite?
Oh God, it probably got to be Cappy. I think she's.
I was gonna say I have seen significantly more fan art of Cappy than anyone else.
Cappy is just really fun. She's just a bundle of joy. There's just so many memorable segments in this game, though. I laughed a lot. I got genuinely creeped out a lot, and I even had a few moments of like genuine like, "Aw, this is kind of sad." They really do a good job of like covering that entire the entire spectrum of emotion with this game that it shocked me, honestly. they also flesh out a lot of the world with collectibles. There's collectibles. It's a 3D game. Got collectibles. But I think that these are collectibles that are worth looking around for because they're little game cartridges that you can find that give you a lot of detailed information on each individual Mita, as well as other players who have played the game. So you can find out, like, well, what did they learn from these different players? And there's, like, a very specific moment where... like, one of the players was an engineer, and he apparently taught her engineering, and that's how she was able to construct the machine that she uses to pull you in. Like, that's just one of the, and you only find that out, you find, like, how did you build this? It's like, you know, I'm good at engineering. And then you find a cartridge later of a player, it's just like, I taught her how to be an engineer. It's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, just casual engineering and world transferring machines. Yeah, no big easy. Deal.
I'm like, man, if you're a character in a mobile game, you probably got nothing but time on your hands. So all of that stuff gives you a more thorough picture of things. And a lot of the game's themes and what it's saying, I think, can really be traced as adjacent to you and me and her, actually. Which, cool. That's a real cool damn game.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to say... more than that and spoil that game because that game is absolutely worth playing. But this game is actively exploring a dynamic scene in video games, like with a focus on the heroine's feelings on things. And I think that even if it's derivative of that and other horror games in like this specific genre, this one just gave me all of those like great game tingles I get when I know I'm playing something cool.
That rules. Yeah. That's so dope.
Yeah, this game was just top to bottom. Like I enjoyed every moment except the parts where I had a power outage in the middle. And
no,
I was like in like near the end of the game, and like one time the game crashed, and then I got back there and a power outage happened. So I had to replay the fucking part of the game 3 times.
Oh my god. Because it only saves between chapters.
Yeah, it only saves between chapters because I think there's so much going on in every chapter. There's so much scripting that they don't want to risk breaking it. So, yeah. Me Side is incredible. Mm-hmm. Just a great piece of interactive fiction, I guess you'd call it. It's
awesome.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember if this one hit you good or not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I liked this game a whole lot.
I'm probably going to have to get back to it because I... played a little bit and then I've seen some streams of it, but like scattered around just different sections. And every time I'm like, what the hell? It looks like a totally different game every time I see it.
Every segment of it. Is just so like that's the thing is I think that this game is not short on creativity. Every segment is so unique and different that like
it's like, okay, now it's doing kind of a PT looping hallway thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, now it's just Doom. What the fuck?
It's so creative. There is no shortage of creativity and just how out there they went with making like every version of the game that you go to unique and interesting and genuinely creepy sometimes. Just like it's top to bottom. I can't think of like a game that like tackles this much and didn't feel like it was spreading itself too thin. But this game just totally avoids that somehow.
Cool.
That's awesome. It's nice when the, like, I'm kind of like behind on horror. I'm not behind on horror games. I just kind of like stopped engaging with a lot of the stuff.
Because indie horror is like an entirely separate genre of games that we don't touch on because it's like as big as regular indie games.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, it's the thing that makes Itch popular.
Horror is like as big as Itch.
Yeah. God.
And then every once in a while you have something like this or the other one. Fuck.
Oh, what? Shit.
The other big one from last year.
Oh, my God. I know exactly. It's the one with the burn victim.
Mouthwashing. Yeah.
Mouthwashing.
The one I played.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I need to get
every
to that
once
one.
In a while, one of those pops through to the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By the mainstream, Rhett means, oh, the VTubers I watch played it.
Dude, mouthwashing, I've heard of people like doing cosplay of. Like, it went way bigger than like us and VTubers.
That's awesome.
And then Meeside came up and was like even more popular in like a week.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, what the fuck? How did mouthwashing somehow? Oh, gee. Yeah.
Right, like, yeah.
I played, like, 20 minutes of that game was like, oh man, this is going to be so much porn of her.
There really is.
It's just so you just get those vibes.
It's built for it. They know what they were doing with that character design. It's so on point. And there's so many versions of her. There's like a version for everybody.
And by everybody, like 50% of them are into Cappy.
Yeah, well, Cappy's really good, man. Go meet Cappy. I guarantee you will be delighted. All right, any other Meeside thoughts before I move on?
Good. It sounds like a good time.
Cool. So I'm kind of mad at my next one because, like, I'm actually not going to talk about it because it's a game that I played that I was a little underwhelmed by, and I was just like, oh, I don't really want to just do a segment about an indie game that's already getting beat up because people are mad you can choose your gender in it. But I had a really funny bit that I don't get to use, and I'm kind of angry about it. So I played Stories from Seoul, The Gun Dog. Like, I was going to be like, I'll be like, all right, guys, and up next, I guess you could say I got that dog in me. I went to a furry convention. But I can't do that now. Because
we're definitely not doing the bit right now.
Not doing the bit right now. Because, like, it's actually really funny to imagine me getting knotted by someone in a fursuit, isn't it? Is it not?
Is it?
Is it not? Is it not?
Oh, John's laughing this time.
All right. John got that one immediately. One for two on bits. Let's go. So, yeah, fuck. I got a little upset that I couldn't do that bit. So I was like, I'm going to have to bring it up. So anyway, I got that horse in me. I went to a...
All right, continue.
That ended up way funnier than I thought it would. I'm laughing at my own stupid bit.
What was the horse you got in you?
I was... I watched the new Uma Musume Pretty Derby Shin Jidai no Tobira, which is a beginning of a new era. Mm-hmm. And I promise I'm not just talking about this because I wanted to make a horse in me joke. That one came to me right in the moment. I wasn't even thinking of that transition.
Oh my god.
So Uma Musume Pretty Derby, this is the horse racing anime, the horse girl racing anime, which we had a speaking of like things where we had a great bit the last time we talked about that show on this podcast was a very good bit, very memorable. They're pooping on the track as they run around. It was great.
Yep,
you had to be there. So the last year I took the Uma Musume journey. I watched all three seasons of the TV series and the OBA, and I came away, you know, pretty happy with most of it for the most part. Seasons one and three. I struggle a bit, three especially, but season two and Road to the Top, solid, just great stuff. So this movie is, as the title is keen to point out, the beginning of a new era. So it's kind of largely focused on new characters, particularly two characters, And a few side characters who I really wish had more time to shine in this movie because they were so good. And I was like, no, there needs to be more of you. Why? Oh, it kind of makes you wish that this was a little more than a movie, but not a full series where they could drop the ball again. But the two main leads are kind of great. And like, they feel a little non-traditional to me for this series because I think like all the leads in this series are typically like, oh, they're just good, spunky girls. And, you know, they just want to be the best. And these two are like, these two are both like, they're both very good racers, but they also come off as kind of heelish and almost villainish. Like Jungle Pocket is this just like brash young upstart type of character, and she's got a chip on her shoulder and just the ability to back it up, and it's just always shit talking everybody like, you're all losers. I'm literally the best.
She's definitely like way more edgy and confrontational than the past protagonists have been.
Yeah.
Who are just these wholesome little cinnamon rolls.
The cinnamon rolls. And then you have Agnes Tachyon, who is similarly at the top of her game.
Horse names.
Yeah, oh, they're so good. Horse racing names are always going to be the best. And Agnes Tachyon is she is also at the top of this era, and she is just absolutely dominant. It is not even a question about her dominance. And like, she's like a mad, also a mad scientist.
Yeah, it's the weirdest turn.
Good.
And you don't think she's going to be a good racer, and then she's also the best racer.
She's the best racer. She's got big floppy sleeves. She runs around in a lab coat. It's very silly. And she's very just Chunibyo, like out the ass, like and her deal is that she is just like looking to surpass the limits of what's possible for herself, as well as like trying to like blow the doors off whatever's possible for limits like of all horse girls in general. Like, that's her whole deal. And so these two characters become like just fierce rivals, and like Jungle Pocket is always kind of chasing after Agnes, like, and like that raw ability and that drive to surpass all boundaries, and she just can never do it. Like, it's never even close. Like, it and then something major happens, and if you are an Uma Musume fan, you probably know this pattern by now. And you know what happens. But these two characters lose the ability to compete with one another. And the movie does a really good job of like digging into and exploring these two, how these two characters have to cope with losing the ability to chase after like what they are looking for. And again, it sounds similar to like season two has this whole thing with Tokai Teo, who is like just always injured at like the worst possible times, and it's just like that girl is like, again, being Tokai Teo is suffering. It's like, and but I think Jungle Pocket's story, like, it spends a lot more quiet time with her trying to struggle with, she is still able to do everything she does at the level she's always done it, but she is never going to achieve the thing that she wants to achieve now because of things that happen. So now she's left with this big hole of like, where does my determination come from then? And it's
that's juicy.
Yeah, it's really juicy. And I like, I think they did a very good job of digging into that like mentality of like still being at the top of your game, but like, what the hell is it for?
What am I doing?
Yeah. Like, what am I even doing when you lose the reason that, you know, you were striving so hard, especially when you were never even close. But, it's bread and butter Uma Musume at its heart, but it's told really well. And it's also presented really well, like, too, because the animation action and all the racing this time around is absolutely being presented at its, like, highest and most intense level. Cygames Animation Studio, whatever they're doing over there, they're absolutely operating at, like, peak performance. Yeah. And then you get to the end credits, it's like, oh, Trigger was also involved with this movie. That makes a lot of directing and animation decisions make sense. So
I think the answer to what Cygames Pictures is doing is they poached a ton of the top talent from a lot of different places.
Yep.
They just made a studio out of nowhere, like,
Because this and Road to the Top are the two things that the studio have produced so far. The TV series were done by other studios, and then they've done Road to the Top and this movie themselves.
They also did Princess Connect, the TV series.
Oh, shit. Right.
They've actually done a decent amount of stuff. But yeah, I think the Umu Musume movies and OVAs are just next level animation for what it is.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So these last two Umu Musume projects have all kind of been like small one-off affairs. Like Road to the Top, which I want to point out, Road to the Top, like if you've not watched Umu Musume at all and you don't really have any intent on getting in, but you still kind of want to see what it's about, Road to the Top is a fantastic way to kind of enjoy what this series is doing without any strings. And it's free to watch on YouTube. And it's only 4 episodes, so it's, you can literally just bang that out in a night if you want to.
And it starts with a shot of the Statue of Liberty, and it pans up, and you realize that the Statue of Liberty is a horse girl.
And the Statue of Liberty is a horse girl. And so this movie and Road to the Top, the thing that like these things benefit from is I think that they're more short form. And I think that works to these stories' strengths in that you're just kind of like, you are kind of retelling a similar story over and over. And that comes with a lot of obvious drama, you know, where these girls can and can't succeed sometimes. And like stretching that out over long periods isn't always going to work the way that it did with Tokai Teo's story. Yeah. So telling that story in like a really small time of like 4 episodes or 90 minutes just works really, really well for what this series is and what it does. And I think it's probably the best way to tell these types of stories in a lot of ways.
That's awesome.
This movie is literally just Umu Musume kind of distilled down to all of the good parts, and then all of those parts operating at like the highest possible level.
The start of this movie, like the first like maybe 15 minutes, are so fast where it's just kind of like yada yada yada. You know how this goes.
Yeah. They burn
has a dream. She's going to be a race. Okay, she's like at the top of her game now. Instantly.
They get you right into like, all right, she is already competing at a high level and doing what she wants to do. And I don't like using silly buzzwords to like describe how I feel about things, but I think that like, even if this like didn't try to take the time and dig into these characters in the same way the TV series might, I was still left really dazzled by it. I think that that's kind of like the feeling I can't, like, I just had a big smile when this was over. I think this movie still does a great job of making me care and rewarding that investment with just a huge catharsis. And it's just a great movie.
Season 2 worked because it used the extra time to develop side characters and give them like their own episodes.
Yeah.
Whereas season 3 didn't.
It focused on a character that and a story that was just not good. It made drama.
Like 12 or 13 episodes.
Yeah. like that's great horse girl movie, turns out. Got that horse in me. All right, so I guess now, if you don't want to hear any spoilers about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, this will be your time to bop on out of the episode, because I think Rhett's about to unload in a way that, you know, well, Rhett's about to unload, if you know what I mean.
In a way that only Rhett can.
In a way that only... So Rhett, hit him up. Does Aeris die or not?
Oh my god, he's starting with the big one.
You can build to it. That was obviously my question going into it.
I was thinking though, was I the one who requested like doing a Final Fantasy spinoff forum on the Discord?
No.
At the time?
No, I think it wasn't specifically other people.
Okay. Because I was personally like, I don't want to hear shit about this game. I don't want to be spoiled, so I'm extending that to other people as well right now.
All right, yeah. If this is where you want to bail, last chance.
Oh my god. So this was a game that took me 100 hours plus to beat.
Yep, great.
Like not even Steam time, but like 105 in-game hours. It's big. It's way too big.
Persona 5 clear time.
I was thinking if I was to score this game, I would give it a 97 because it's basically it's 100 hours long. 97 of them were great. And then there's three that were kind of shitty, like really shitty. There's a Khate Sith dungeon that's really bad.
I've heard so many people say this thing's so bad.
So that's one of the hours. And it's really unfortunate that the other two bad hours are the last two.
Yep. Yeah, Trex.
But I don't want that to overshadow the entire discussion. So we're going to go back to a Final Fantasy remake, the first half of this thing.
Sure. First third of this journey.
I think right now it's going to end up being like the first 20% given the actual length of these things. So that was called Final Fantasy VII Remake. And then you find out partway through that they're not really directly remaking it.
Mm-hmm. Like that, like we've been seeing with some large franchises lately.
They saw Ava and went, me too.
Yeah.
So the thing in that one is that like events would keep happening that were about to diverge from the original game. Like a character was about to die or a character that did die was about to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Things called the Whispers would swoop in and like push characters around.
Yeah, just literally to keep push them out of the way.
It's so fucking stupid.
Oh my god, I didn't know about this.
Oh, it's so dumb, but it's my kind of dumb.
I hate the Whispers. I could point to one thing of what. Let me start my timer just so I know where we're at on time. So at the end of that game, you basically go through the events of Midgar in Final Fantasy VII, and you escape on the highway, and the characters get off like the truck that they're escaping in. And then step through a portal that opens up and fight Sephiroth for like 20 minutes.
Great.
And then they defeat the Whispers. So the Whispers are revealed to be the arbiters of fate or trying to keep things as they were in the original game.
Follow the script. And you
Sucks so bad.
It's so bad. It's so like trying to have their Kingdom Hearts big moment, I think.
Okay, keep going.
So you defeat the concept of fate at the end of that game.
What's it called again? The Whisper fragment?
Well, the Whispers are just like these like ghost-looking things that fly around and are annoying.
Yeah. This is when I found out. I was like all in on spoilers, and I looked it up, the final boss of FF7, and it was like, what is it? What is this fucking thing called? Because it's the most Kingdom Hearts shit in the universe. The Whisper Harbinger.
Yeah.
That you fight at Destiny's Crossroads. That's a fucking Kingdom Hearts level.
And there's also a bunch of Sephiroth fights and like things similar to the statues in Final Fantasy VI. Like, it's just having a huge moment that is completely unearned.
Uh-huh.
So you defeat the Whispers at the end of Remake, and then you just kind of walk off to start Rebirth. It's really weird, because then they have to shift from that to, okay, let's go to the Town of Calm and have a flashback. Like, it's such an insane non sequitur. But the reason at the time that I thought they did this whole thing about defeating fate and the future is ours to hold and do whatever we want with is that they were acknowledging that they weren't capable of actually remaking the entire game.
Yeah.
And that they were going to like heavily truncate or diverge with further installments.
Mm hmm.
And then Rebirth comes out, and it's just the rest of Disc 1 of Final Fantasy VII, for the most part.
Great.
They just said, just kidding, we're making the game that I personally thought was impossible for them to make. Mm. Where it's just, you have the Sephiroth flat. I mean, okay, this is just full like game spoilers at this point.
It's
just Disc 1 again. You have you go to Calm, you get a story flashback with Sephiroth, which is a good way to start the game, I think.
Like, yeah, that's a really big, great part of the game.
Yeah, and reintroduce him as like a main antagonist, ignoring what happened in the remake of you fighting him like four times.
Cool.
And then you come to a swamp, and they're like, we need some chocobos to cross this swamp. And then you get some chocobos, and then you fight the big Midgar Zalem snake. And they do change that up a little bit with, like, how Sephiroth works with that. Mm-hmm. So, like, things aren't exactly the same as they were before, but they don't have the Whispers jumping in to fuck everything up. They just they're able to remix things in a way that makes sense for this game, but keeping the general story beats exactly the same still. And I think that's pretty smart. So then you go to Junon, you go to the upper decks, and you, oh yeah, they keep the whole like lower Junon dolphin stuff.
So funny. That's so funny. Fucking funny. Like, I was waiting to hear if they kept the dolphin mini game.
They keep the story beat where like a girl is drowning in the water and you go over there and there's a big like fish monster boss to fight, except this time the girl drowning is Yuffie.
But the
girl from the original game is still there, present. They keep it all so similar where it's just like you remember, but it's actually a little bit off. Mm-hmm. And then you do the whole parade sequence at Upper Junon. Remember how they did the honeybee stuff in remake?
Over the top, like, insane.
It's that again.
Oh god, it's so like good.
Big crazy sweeping camera movements and choreography QTEs.
Nice.
There's like you pick the difficulty of your like regiment's performances beforehand. I went with the hardest one on all cases, and I was not rewarded for doing that because I'm not that super good at QTE. But like, you don't actually fail it. It's just like, okay, you don't get like an elixir at the end or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you cross. Then you get on a boat. You go to what's it called? The Coast of the Soul. Coast but the boat sequence is crazy because they do add in a whole. you play. There's a whole card game tournament on there.
Oh, good.
Which is okay. Polly's apprehension with this game is that there's a shitload of mini games and that they're all forced, and they are totally not. The card game tournament. One character says, "Anyways, talk to me if you don't want to do this bullshit." Basically, instantly before you've played a single time.
Oh.
They let you opt out of virtually everything, almost to the game's detriment at times. But the card game tournament is so fucking funny. It's all, of all things you think they're not going to go like really over the top with, they do. Because you get to the, I guess I'll just spoil what I think is funniest moment in the game. You win the tournament, I won the tournament, and then a character comes out and is like, "Hold on, we've got one more match to play." And the character that comes out is Red 13 wearing human clothes, walking on two legs.
I can't believe this.
So the final match against this mystery opponent is Red 13 in a trench coat, basically. I screamed.
I would just be hooting and hollering.
It's incredible. So, and then you fight Genova on the boat, and then you go to Coast of the Soul, and there's a bunch of mini games in Coast of the Soul as well. Mm-hmm.
And then
so the Corel region has a lot of events and stuff. I'm going to, you know, try to yada yada a bit. Because you got Coast of the Soul, then you have the Mountain Path, then you have Barret's Hometown, then you have the Golden Saucer, which is also insanely extra and over the top. And then there's like 10 more minigames there, of course. Then you got the prison underneath, which is kind of like a Mad Max hellscape now. They changed it a little bit theme-wise. Up till this point, I'm like, this is the best game I've ever played. this game is perfect. I think the open world stuff at this point starts to really wear out its welcome a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because those are the first three regions. The last three, though, you have Gongaga, Cosmo Canyon, and Nibelheim. And the thing about those is that in the original game, they're just single towns.
Yeah.
So building those out into large open world areas where there is exactly one place you need to go is a little weird.
Yeah.
Cosmo Canyon is the funniest one because it's literally like you start on like the bottom left corner and there's a straight path up and you can either get some chocobos and go to the open world or go to the actual Cosmo Canyon town. So I got the chocobos. I jumped off a cliff into the valley and I did open world bullshit for like 5 or 6 hours and I 100% cleared it.
Wow.
But then by the end, I'm just like, but how the fuck do I get to the town? And I realized you have to literally go back to the start and like there's a left turn near the chocobo section.
Are you fucking kidding me?
It's just It's literally signposted. There's a bunch of signposts everywhere saying Cosmo Canyon this way.
Right.
I can't believe this. That I had
seen at the start, but I wasn't like trying to go there at the start, so I ignored them. It's just, it's the most clear divide where the open world is over here and the main story is over here, and they are 100% separate. Like, there's no overlap, and it's really funny.
That's so funny.
And then Nibelheim is kind of a weird region to end on because it's just a bummer of an area.
Yeah.
It's just this gray, overcast kind of, it's nature, but it's like kind of ugly nature, really.
Wow.
But also the chocobos you get in that area, every region has its unique chocobo breeds. Mm-hmm. The ones in that area like can fly and by over water by like doing a jet stream thing, which I joke that looks like they're pissing really, really hard. So it is this weird dichotomy of like the open world stuff is fun. You're flying around in chocobo. Also Nibelheim. Mm. There's a fun place to visit. Nibelheim after it burned to the ground and Great. Everybody fucking died.
Good stuff.
Incredible.
Who's ready for a good time?
Just a nice little chill time.
Yeah. So we talked about how the end of the first game remake, it went absurdly huge for no mm-hmm. real reason at all. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, all that stuff with like the Harbinger's Fate and fighting Sephiroth was after an insanely well done Shinra Tower.
Oh, the Shinra Tower's so good.
It's like it's good enough to be the climax of the game by itself.
Yeah, that's all they needed to do.
At the top of the tower, you fight they do add a Genova fight there, which yeah. I'm like a little iffy on. But then you fight mm-hmm. Rufus, then you fight the elevator boss, and then you escape on the motorcycle, and then you fight like that thing on from the elevator motorball chases you down the highway. It's crazy. It's super over the top. I'm like, I was so happy. Like, this was a great game. Puts the controller down, thinks it's over. And then this fucking portal opens up. And then, like, my opinion tanks for the next 2 hours.
So fucking funny.
So, like, there's moments like Shinra Tower in this game where they're just like, what if we just go really hard for, like, an hour with, like, four bosses in a row? And I love that shit.
I mean, that's the coolest thing with Kingdom Hearts too, is like, it'll just turn into a Kamiya game for a couple hours, and it's the coolest shit in the world.
It's so fun. I figured this out when talking to John earlier. It's so fun when they do that in a way that doesn't break the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause like of all things, the moment between Barret and Dine is one of them where you have the one-on-one fight with Barret and Dine. It gets really silly by the end because Dine kind of turns into Tetsuo, or not one of the Kira villain. I forget which one it was. Mm-hmm. He has like robot arm that's like summoning laser beams from space. It's it's weird.
Why does why is this man still in prison if he can summon lightning bolts from the sky?
It's so weird. But then they have like the sentimental moment afterwards that I never really cried at this game, but I did tear up several times. I actually think that scene is really well done, where it's just like Barret and Dine like refusing to kill each other, but then also being like, whoever lives
gotta take care of the kid.
You're gonna feel this fucking guilt of what you've done. The burden, like defeat is living because you have to live with, you know, guilt.
Yeah.
But then there's like two boss fights after that, and it just keeps escalating. Guys, and you're just like,
you had your moment. No, why did you?
No, I love that shit. They move the one area from the original game that they skip is Rocket Town.
Oh,
so they take the boss from Rocket Town and put it there.
Oh, weird.
Interesting. Weird.
It's really, I think it's really well done. And then there's like you get the buggy, like the like kind of six-wheel rover thing. Mm-hmm. You get that and do a boss fight from it.
Does Palmer get hit by a truck?
I don't think he gets hit by a truck, but he does.
No.
He does do the thing where he jumps out and shakes his ass at you.
I need this man hit by a truck.
He does gotta get hit by a truck, Rhett.
Okay, I don't remember literally every beat of the original game. Maybe he does, and I didn't recognize it as a reference. But he's definitely there, and it's very funny. Mm. And then the Gongaga reactor scene is also one that just goes really absurdly big out of nowhere. They apparently in a dev interview, they considered ending the game at that point. And I'm just like, bro, they were like, oh, but we can't because there's still like 60% of the original game to make.
Yeah.
It's way too early. But like, I was probably like 50 or 60 hours in at that point. I was like, lengthwise, it wouldn't be crazy for the game to be over a year.
It would just be on par with the first game, because that would took me 45 hours.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it peters out a little bit towards the end with the open world stuff. And then after Nibelheim, you have more easier access to the whole rest of the game. And it, like, you can back travel between maps, I guess is what mm-hmm. I'm saying. And I thought I was so done with the open world stuff at that point, and they take that opportunity to add new quests to every region. I'm just like, oh, okay. It finally broke me where I didn't do literally everything, because the last couple quests are actually genuinely hard. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, there's this one long quest through the entire game called the Proto Relic thing, and the climax of that ends up being, oh, by the way, you have to refight all the summons two at a time.
Geez.
I'm just like,
that kind of rips.
Oh,
that's like, cool that they did that. That's cool that that's there for people that want it.
Sure, but
it's so hard. I haven't uninstalled the game yet. I said I was done. I'm gonna dial it to easy and see how fucked up those fights are. Because I was reading, one of them is against Phoenix. So guess what the fuck they do?
Oh yeah, I bet. Oh, the fun thing that John likes, where they could full heal.
Yay!
No, they revive the other one in this fight.
Oh,
I think it's like Tooth. There's two summons.
You gotta kill them at the same time or within like a very quick window.
I think you have to kill Kujita, mm-hmm. then Phoenix, and then as it dies, Phoenix will bring Kujita back.
Oh, good.
Fuck, that's funny.
I'm just like, bro, these are like very long and hard fights. I'm tired. I saw people saying to like get to level 70 before doing this. I finished the game at like 49.
Oh, God.
They went so over the top with stuff to do in this game. Continuing on the main quest, they build Temple of the Ancients into a really appropriate final dungeon. Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
That's what I would want. That is the
place to do it.
Yeah, it's like, it feels more like maybe appropriate than Shinra Tower as a final dungeon, even though that worked pretty well too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it felt like they were using this as a way to keep all the themes of the game, like, consistent. I'm like, oh, this is actually a really cool final dungeon, and then like they really kind of trails it up, if you know what I mean.
Oh, God.
In later segments.
Oh, good. Let's go.
You fight a dragon.
Yeah.
Good.
You fight the Turks twice.
Yeah.
Good.
And then you fight a demon wall.
Mm-hmm. Gotta have a demon wall in there.
Up until this point, I was like, this game is basically perfect. Ship it. 99% score on mail or whatever. And then everything after Demon Wall is when they're like, okay, let's fuck it up now.
Hey, like Whispers?
The Whispers fucking come back.
Of course, baby!
Mm-hmm. But they're not representing fate anymore. I don't know what... I heard you die just now. I'm not as mad as I was at the end of Remake because I knew this was coming.
Right.
Yeah. I don't actually think it's as bad and as big of a swerve as Remake's ending was. But there's just some stuff that's so fucking dumb. There's like the Whispers now follow Sephiroth. And then there's White Whispers that follow Aerith.
Oh, no, I see what they're setting up.
Maybe it is really bad now that I say it out loud.
Oh, no. Okay.
It's just, it's really cheesy and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's not really explained at all. Like, the best interpretation is that it's like she represents the planet fighting against Sephiroth who wants to destroy it.
It's stupid, though.
It's just stupid. So, backing up a little bit is that all of the Zack segments are different from the original game.
Mm hmm.
Because in the original game, I remember you would have like these brief dream sequences about this guy you didn't know, and it was kind of building the mystery. The Zack sequences actually start at the end of Remake, where he walks into Midgar after the events that have just happened at the end of the game. But there's a thing that signals that he's in a different alternate timeline.
Yeah. These are happening and in they, parallel. They're like, it feels like they're trying to do like an overlapped kind of timeline thing.
Yeah. There's at least two timelines that are happening together. And there's a, so all those sequences of him in the alternate universe are, kind of replace the dream stuff from the original game. And I was truly hoping they were going somewhere with this. And it's like, I mean, I guess I'm just going full spoilers at this point. Well. Biggs is there too, alive. Biggs and Zach talk about their experiences in the original timeline,
right,
where they were about to die. Like, Zach talks about the end of Crisis Core, and Biggs talks about, like, being on the Sector 7 thing as it was watching it crumble. And so for a minute, I'm like, oh, it's not an alternate timeline. It's the live stream.
Right.
Because they talk about in this game all the time that no one actually truly dies. They just return to the live stream. And then the nonsense that occurs at the end of this game is just like, just kidding, it's an alternate universe.
Oh,
we're not going to explain how these two consciousnesses jumped over. You just do it to get a really, really stupid boss fight at the end. Where you fight Multiverse Sephiroth or whatever the fuck. It's just like a
disaster.
It's weird because, again, it still ends with them continuing the original story where it was. It's just you have this 2-hour nonsense that happens right after Temple of the Ancients.
Couldn't help themselves.
They just couldn't help themselves because... I think the one thing I am truly, truly disappointed by this game is that the last area after the actual Temple of the Ancients is the Forgotten City or Forgotten Capital. Yeah. Anyways, you know, it's like the seashell looking underwater one. Very cool, quiet, solemn moment in the original game. Mm-hmm. And you walk up to it and it looks exactly like you'd expect it to in an HD remake. And I'm like, oh, yes, beautiful. Instantly, a million whispers come out, white and black, and start having a battle over it. And so stupid. And then Cloud runs forward through the crowd of whispers. He leaves behind the party members. He's off to save Aerith. And then I'm not going to say anymore.
Gotcha.
But they just try to make it into this big set piece. And I'm just like, man.
They started out this remake project going big in the best ways possible with that opening with Wall Market, with the Honeybee Inn, all of that shit, the Shinra Tower, all that shit. They just went so damn hard on it. And then they felt like they always feel like, oh, I want to go once. It's like that guy, like when you're telling a joke and everybody's telling a joke and making it worse. And then there's that guy that takes it way too far. And turns it into something horribly offensive.
Yeah.
That's kind of what this remake project is starting to sound like.
But again, I don't want the last couple hours to overshadow the fact that they did just do a version of that game that goes big for like 80 plus hours.
Yeah.
And they just do it.
Only
perfectly.
Only Mahime
exactly
is capable of ruining everything in its last... You know, 20%.
I love the bones that I love the.
We'll never let that
be carrying for 20 years.
Never letting it go.
Exquisite.
Through everything, I was only like really disappointed that I felt they missed the tone of the Forgotten Capital entirely, where they don't let you explore it, they don't let it be quiet, they just immediately go loud with it. It's like different from everything else in the game.
Lame.
But yeah. So should I say at the end of Aerith dies or not?
No.
Tell
us off the save something. Okay. Save something. Just in case because even I got this far, and I don't even think I want to know.
Okay.
Because I may play this at some point still. Because again,
talk so much about it. I think you should play it and ignore as much side stuff as you possibly
can. Okay. I can do that too because I have access to that game. So
yeah. I wonder how underleveled you'd be because they have three difficulty modes. You could just play on easy if you really want to. But
if I get stuck, if I get too stuck, I'm not above it.
I haven't even talked about how much I like the combat.
That's so weird, because that is the thing that I consistently hear griped about, especially with the first game, is that it was like, it wasn't dialed in yet. Like, it, did they tighten it up? Or is it still the same?
I don't know. I can't articulate the ways in which it's different, because it just felt perfect to me.
Huh.
I think there's maybe a little bit more where, like, you have synergy attacks where, like, from a block, you can summon a partner in your team to do a big attack that's really slow. Mm-hmm. And that helps raise ATB. There's just a fucking ton of depth to the combat, and it feels like a fun action game if you're just mashing anyways.
The thing with the first game is that you're just always eating damage no matter what. Like, enemies are just always shooting you. Like, it's no matter where you go, you're just constantly getting pegged. So you can't avoid damage. And, like, Cloud, for being, you know, this agile character with, like, you know, a lot of fancy-ass anime moves, felt like controlling a fucking bathtub sometimes in combat.
It must be way better than, because I don't feel that, especially with the movement stuff.
Okay.
I think because you're fighting monsters much, much more in this one.
Good.
You don't have enemies with machine guns just forcing you to take damage.
Yeah, yeah. Like the humanoid fights in Remake just felt terrible.
Yeah. I feel like I did think about it during the final boss, where I felt like this is way too fucking chaotic. I can't dodge all this shit. Mm-hmm. For the entire 99 hours beforehand, I didn't feel like I was forced to eat damage constantly. Unless an enemy was casting, like, the lightning spell that always hits you.
Of course.
But you can block that to, you know, take half damage. But, like, Yuffie has, like, an iframe dodge that it uses ATB, but if you dodge an attack with it, you get it back. So, like, that's really fun. Cloud has parries and stuff. Like, I feel there's a lot of depth to the combat this time that made it really fun the entire time.
Okay, so like the combat in the first game just largely felt like me slamming my sword into things as often as I could, blocking, trying to build ATB, waiting till you have ATB until you can do something of real use, and then getting the stagger bar going with the proper element, all of that stuff. It just felt like, I didn't hate it. I thought it was, you know, like serviceable for the most part, except when you were fighting a lot of humanoid enemies that just block everything you do and then counter immediately. Like the Turk fights
in the last 15 at least.
Yeah, like the Turk fights in that first game are miserable.
There's one fight against Reno specifically, who is the counter character, and he's still a bastard.
Oh, he sucks so much.
I was like, okay, I'm going to take care of the other one first, because I still don't know what to do with Reno. Yeah, I was thoroughly, thoroughly entertained by this game pretty much the entire time. And I will wrap things up by making a shot in the dark. Mm-hmm. Last year, I said, I hope I play 10 games better than Tevi.
Okay.
This year... Let's see if I play one game better than Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
We are throwing the gauntlet down. Holy shit.
I started this at the end of January. I was like, oh my God, am I playing Game of the Year this early?
I mean, that happened to me one year when I played Transfer Ruby. Yeah. So
that was crazy. That one made the climb. This one is starting at the top.
This one's just literally sitting at the top of the mountain. It's just like, come knock me off.
There's so many mini. There's so much. I could talk for like another half an hour about like all the mini games and like the Fort Condor that are just like entire sub games into themselves.
Yeah.
It's insane. There's two different RTSs.
Yeah. That's insane.
There's Fort Condor, and then there's like a hacking one later on. I prefer. Okay, last thing. The combat where you're doing melee combat and then waiting for ATP, I call that real time with pause. Now I understand what all those computer nerds were about. I'm like, oh, this is the best combat system.
Oh,
it's basically just Baldur's Gate.
Probably. Because I think it is, like, I turn all the stuff to control the AI, like, automatically off. Mm-hmm. So I'm just inputting the ATB for everyone. Mm. And I'm just like, this is very fun.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Having that level of control helps.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for sharing the arc of it with you.
I was wondering how this was going to land. This one was really just kind of like, man, because I'm still so invested, right? Like, I really like that first game a lot. And it's just like, as much as I hate mini games and open world shit, I still just want to experience, maybe.
The highs of this game are so high. Yeah,
that's really kind of what's probably going to do.
Where I think maybe a tighter, more focused experience of just doing the main story stuff would be unreal good.
Engaging when I have to with the side content to just kind of make sure I'm not falling all the way behind.
Fucking... Oh, all the minigame or all the side quest stuff is directed by Chadley, and I just hate him.
Oh, Chadley sucks so much. I just, I don't. He's
got your,
he's got
your cell phone number this time. He calls you constantly.
I don't often want to punch children. That's a lie, actually. Never mind. I'll skip that line.
Brett.
Yeah.
This still sounds like John Poison, but I'm very glad that I get to hear your arc with that.
Final Fantasy VII, but it's like six times longer. It's
six times longer, and the whole theming is about, can we defeat the forces of fate by undoing these character deaths that happened? Wouldn't that be great?
Like the
Isn't that what you want?
The ultimate in everything I hate about other things right now.
just like the anime girl holding up the crossed arms. Nope. I'm very excited to look up spoilers for FF7R3.
Oh God.
Yeah.
And you know, I hope they do
a great time looking up spoilers for this one.
All right.
So that's it.
Cool. That's Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And that is another Sox cast in the can.
In the bag.
We did it. Look at us go back on the bike. Mm-hmm. Like it never stops. With us getting out of here, John Thayer, tell the internet folks at home where they can find you.
Farawaytimes.itch.io and farawaytimes.com.
All right. And Rhett!
X.com/Rhett.
And I'm basically Polyplushy everywhere. We will catch you back here in another couple weeks or three. So until then, of course.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
If you're just listening to the podcast, I do have I think we all have blue skies now, right?
We do. I think we're all the same thing there, though, aren't we? Like, I'm just Polyplushy on blue sky.
Yeah, I'm Far Away Times. And
Rhett's just Rhett. So, yeah, we're all on blue sky. I don't mess with Twitter anymore. So,
I don't Mastodon. I'm also a Mastodon, but I'm more of a goblin posting on there. But I know no one's coming to Mastodon, so I'm not mad.
Nah.
I'm not mad.
Nah.
It's extinct.
Man, why do they even call it Mastodon? You know? All right, folks, we will catch you next time. But until then, remember, we are the podcast that loves you. We're the only ones that love you.